This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, music from DePaul. This week, we have a student corner in which we talk about what it's like to audition for and win our annual concerto competition. We find out why saxophone professor Scotty Stepp never leaves home without a pair of pliers. And anticipating a wonderful visit from world-renowned baritone Thomas Hampson and the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra this weekend, Professor Matthew Valenzuela joins us to chat about some music of Mahler that we'll be hearing, and voice professor Pam Coburn gives us the inside scoop on working with Thomas Hampson. There are lots of exciting things going on in the DePaul School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. We have a very exciting weekend coming up with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra and special guest Thomas Hampson. So this week on Music for Life, we're having two segments on this performance, the first of which is going to talk a little bit about the music, and we welcome one of our music historians, Dr. Matthew Valenzuela. Welcome.
Hi.
Good to have you here. Thanks for stopping in.
Thank you.
This is an interesting program, and Thomas Hampson is known for his Mahler.
Yes, it's his specialty. He's performed it a number of times with orchestra and the piano version. And the collection, The Magic Wunderhorn, is a very interesting one. They're a set of poems that were collected in the early part of the 19th century by two literary people who wanted to get to the sort of folk tradition of Germany. So they're sort of like the literary version of the Grimm brothers.
Mm-hmm,
Instead
mm-hmm.
of fairy tales, they're collecting these folk songs, and they feel this is the true German spirit. And so Mahler's coming to it several generations later, and instead of setting it just as folk songs, it's more like a movie soundtrack. Things come and sweep in, the river flows, the fish jump. In a lot of ways, even if you don't understand German, you can still get the sense and the meaning of the songs.
Mahler was very taken by these. He kept coming back to them, correct?
Yes, they appear not only in this collection, but they appear in his symphonies, they appear in other guises, the melodies pop up in different places, sometimes with voices, sometimes not.
Yeah, Mahler was an interesting character in that way, in that his symphonies and his songs blended together in interesting ways. Material from songs appeared in symphonies, and his songs are often symphonic in many ways. But this was originally a piano work, correct?
Yes. Piano and voice.
Did he do the orchestrations?
Yes. He went back to them and reorchestrated them. He has a very, almost again, movie soundtrack version of what the orchestra is.
Mm-hmm.
He has a lot of players, but they don't all work all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes you hear this very small chamber group, and every now and then, zam, the whole orchestra screams out, and everyone starts playing very loud, and then it goes really back to being very quiet. So if you imagine, again, like a movie soundtrack where suddenly Frodo's walking off in the forest and this orchestra jumps out and suddenly they go back and then it's just a few instruments. It's constantly shifting.
And it's radically different when you hear it as a piano work. It seems that Mahler's orchestrations add a whole new dimension because of that thing that you're referring to.
I definitely think so. One way you might want to think about it is that music really hints at things.
Mm-hmm.
It can hint at things very subtly. And when you have only a few instruments or just a piano, you can make allusions, but they're not quite as strong. So if you want to represent a meadow, you might have some very light sounds up on the top range of the piano. But if you have a whole orchestra and you can put in an oboe and a bassoon
right.
and lots of lush strings, it's the same notes, same pitches, but you can make the allusion a little more strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what Mahler does. He's constantly pushing you to hear references to things that he can only allude to. The text helps you a little bit. But again, I'd like to just assure listeners that if you don't understand German, it doesn't really matter, because all this pushing in other ways, all this mm-hmm. massaging of the meaning of the thing really comes out clearly, I think, even if you don't speak German.
It's very interesting because folks will come to a concert, and it's interesting for me to watch them. Some people are glued to their program. They're they're reading word for word to absorb every syllable and every word and every meaning. Others don't open their programs at all because they're just allowing the music to carry them, and they're not that concerned with every individual jot and tittle of the line.
Right. You asked me to give a little pre-concert talk mm-hmm. for the student group, and definitely one of the things I want to say is that there is a sort of aesthetic imperative we have that you must go to the concert and be overwhelmed and have, you know, and if you don't do that, you somehow failed as a concert goer. And the real truth of going to concerts is sometimes they're really very moving, and sometimes they're just enjoyable and not so much so. And there might be many things for that. Could be what you ate beforehand.
Right. Or your mood at the moment.
Right. And just to assure everyone who comes to the concert that there's no one right answer. It's hard for a college teacher to say that. But there is no one right aesthetic answer.
Except on your tests.
They should come and enjoy whatever. And for some people, knowing a lot of the history, knowing the dates, knowing some facts enhances that. For other people, it doesn't really matter. And however you react to the music is just fine.
Right. You mentioned the pre-concert get-together. The School of Music is hosting the CLA, the College of Liberal Arts students, in a pre-concert reception as a chance to give a taste of the life of the opera goer or the symphony goer. And I've asked Dr. Valenzuela to come and to give just like a 5-minute introduction to these works that we're about to hear so that students have some handle on what they're about to hear. But you make a very good point, and that is that it's not as if you have homework to do before you come to these things. This music is really very accessible and enjoyable if you knew nothing about it whatsoever, correct?
It's tailgating in a tuxedo.
Yes, are you bringing the barbecue? Do you have the grill?
You have a big picture of Mahler on my grill. I think it is like that. I mean, you do something fun. You get together with your friends just because it's fun. And I think a lot of people, we just had the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know the subtleties of zone blitzing or bump and run coverage, but they still enjoy the game.
Right.
And the concert should be just like that. You should get together with your friends. You should enjoy it. You should have a lot of fun. If you want to dig in and learn all that stuff and listen to all the commentary before and afterwards, that's fine. But if you don't enjoy the game or enjoy the concert another way, that's perfectly fine.
Are there some particularly great moments in this that you would bring up or that you particularly like?
One of the most famous parts of the Wunderhorn is a folk song that talks about St. Anthony preaching to the fishes. Mm-hmm. It's historically interesting because the original poem is not complete, and the original collectors of the song actually wrote the last couple of verses of the poem to sort of bring it to a logical conclusion. So it's another example of the folk material being sort of massaged a little bit into more artistic ways. And here's an example where Mahler writes very vivid music. There's a little river, da 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 da, and the music flows and these little chirping, tleet, 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 which is the fishes jumping out when they hear the saint's sermon. So there's an example where the music just represents absolutely what the words mean, and there's a direct correlation.
That's an excellent example. And we also have Schumann on the program, so it's an interesting pairing. We've got Schumann's Second Symphony. Mm-hmm. Schumann, an interesting character in his own right, with a whole life of things that would be interesting to dig into and read about. But I think this makes for an excellent program. And it's really not a difficult program for someone who has little prior experience with classical music to appreciate, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think they're very enjoyable pieces. They're very melody-driven, so very melodic. You can just follow along with the theme. They're fully orchestrated, very lush. There's not a lot of hidden number crunching. Mm-hmm. You don't have to think about symbolic representation of this or that. Right. In both of them, if you hear music flowing like a river, then the music's probably trying to represent a river. It's very, very straightforward and immediate.
I think folks are really going to love this evening. It's going to be a fun evening for us. And kudos to the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. They've just raised $5.2 million to head off their budget impasse. And they're back in full strength, and we're thrilled that they're joining us here at DePauw. And thanks for coming in, Dr. Valenzuela, to talk with us about it.
Thank you.
So let's hear St. Anthony preaching to the fishes. This is our guest this weekend, Thomas Hampson, performing with the Vienna Virtuosos from Deskenhagen Wunderhorn.
Zur Predigt, die Kirche wird ledig, er geht zu den Flüssen und predigt den Fischen. Sie schlagen mit den Schwänzen, im Sonnenschein glänzen, im Sonnenschein, Sonnenschein glänzen, sie glänzen. Karpfen mit Rogen sind all hier erzogen, haben Mäule auf Rissen, sich zu Herz befließen. Kein Predigt niemand,
in Fischen so gefallen. Spitzgoschete Hechte, die immer zu fechten, sind einens verschwommen, zu hören den Frommen. Auch jene Phantasten, die immer zu fasten, die Stockfisch, ich meine, zur Predigt erscheinen. Kein Predigt niemals, den Stockfisch so gefallen.
This year at Winter Term, we offered a very unusual course, one that should be required, I think, of every music major, but an unusual course all the same, and that was instrument repair. You see, oftentimes these instruments have some type of difficulty, and you can't get it to the store before your gig, and you've got to know how these things work. So we were fortunate to have Professor Scotty Stepp teach this class, and we have also joining us Kevin Smith, a student in the class, to chat about that. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Stepp, I didn't know that you were an instrument repairman. This is news.
It's not something I advertise because inevitably if you do, then
everyone brings you their instruments.
Exactly. I had a couple of courses in my undergrad degree. I was fortunate enough to have an instrument repair course. Mm-hmm. Since then, you know, as starving musicians go, we were looking for extra ways to make income. And so I've done it on and off for the past 15, 20 years. Mm. In particular, you know, expertise in saxophone, since that's mm-hmm. my instrument. But certainly, so many of the things that we do, a pad falling out or a cork or a felt falling off, all those things are basically fixed the same mm-hmm. way in the woodwind world.
Yeah, these are highly complicated instruments. Right. The simplest little misadjustment, misalignment, can just wreak havoc on the performance.
That's very true. And it's happened to me on several occasions. You know, one cork falls out and then something doesn't work as it should. You know, we do the best we can. The show
one
must
tiny
go
little
on.
Leak and then your whole instrument stops.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Right. It was an invaluable course for me as a student and now as a professional, especially for future music educators and performers. You know, I mean, it's inevitable especially at a beginning level where these instruments aren't put together, very well, you know. So the kids come to you, you know, as you're standing on the podium getting ready to start the concert with, you know, a felt or a pad in one hand and said, can you fix this?
I can't tell you the number of times chewing gum has come in handy for me in trying to fix something moments before.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because any port and storm.
That's right. So my concept, I guess, for the course was to kind of be able to give students the ability to, on the spot, be able to fix things, and most importantly, have the confidence and the ability to fix them, you know, and to diagnose.
So did that work for you, Kevin?
Worked very well. I have a much better appreciation and knowledge of how my instrument operates. We completely stripped and reassembled saxophones, clarinets, flutes, so I now understand all the mechanisms on them. And what I really appreciated about the course was that we would start with a best possible circumstance. Something breaks and you have all of your tools in front of you and all of your corks, and then we would work on worst case scenario. So you have 30 seconds before a concert, and flute's at a crazy angle, and someone stepped on it, bent on it. How do you fix it?
Right.
And so it was really, really great to have different situational awareness and knowledge.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Apollo 13 moment. You know, here's a box of stuff. What can you build out of this
that'll
make sure we get home? And you kind of have that. You know, you've got, okay, well, here's the pieces that you've got, and you've got, you know, your fingernail clippers and the key to your office. So what can you make? It's kind of that MacGyver moment.
That's right. Yeah. Definitely. So we you know, the bulk of the time that we spent was focused on woodwind instruments. Mm-hmm. I mean, for sure. I mean, because like you said, they're pretty highly complicated, mm-hmm. you know, so we were able to disassemble all those instruments. But we spent some time on brass instruments. You know, everybody needs to be able to know how to use a mouthpiece puller.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
that's,
you know,
not the door.
Not the door, that's right, or your teeth.
Yeah.
So we spent some time, you know, everybody had to pull a stuck mouthpiece. And it was a little bit funny, and I figured this would be the case, but we first had to get a mouthpiece stuck.
Right.
And so
and you couldn't pull it off.
They're always stuck
until you want it.
That's
stuck.
Exactly right. So, you know, I said, okay, I need a volunteer to, you know, get a mouthpiece stuck. And of course, all the brass players were like instantly junior high kids again. Oh, I'll do it, you know. So everybody did that. And then we had everybody restring one of the valves of a French horn.
Mm-hmm.
And then percussion, we pretty much avoided altogether.
Right, right.
You know, the scope of the class was not long enough. And I just told everybody, look, find a percussionist. They're everywhere.
Right.
Bring in a professional to actually do that. But I think everybody took away some valuable lessons and the confidence to fix.
These are highly, especially on the woodwind side, they're highly complicated instruments. But sometimes the simplest thing can be the fix. If you don't know what it is, you know, so you take time and send it off to the repair person who spends 1.2 seconds fixing the problem, and then you go, God, I could have done that myself if I'd have known that was the problem.
That's exactly right, yeah. Being able to diagnose a problem was an important part, I thought, of their education from this course.
Yeah, there's so much more that goes into being a musician than people ever imagine. You know, I remember the Itzhak Perlman breaking a string, and you know, just as they were about to start and having to quickly deal with that and the headaches that come along with that. So did this ever happen to you?
I was actually halfway through my high school career, my summer of my junior year, I was chosen to go perform in Europe with an honors band. And we got on a plane in Chicago and landed in England, and we had about 2 hours-ish to get to the gig. On our way, we're sitting on a bus, and I opened my saxophone to look at it just in case. Well, turns out when someone had loaded it on the plane, they had tossed it a little bit too forcefully and completely flattened one of the guards over one of my keys.
Ooh.
And it couldn't work at all. Luckily, one of the adults on the tour with us had taken an instrument repair course, and he had a pair of pliers in his suitcase. Using just a pair of pliers, he was able to get the screws undone, flatten it back out on a rock with a pair of pliers, and totally jerry-rigged, you know, looked terrible, but it got me through the tour, and then when I got back, I brought it to a professional, and then I got it done a little bit more.
So that it even looked pretty then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it got the job done, and in a pinch, it was exactly what I needed.
Yeah. How about you? Ever happened to you?
Yes, we put a saxophone quartet together to play at the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra after concerts.
Mm-hmm.
The composer had actually been invited to talk with the audience and perform. his piece. And so we sat down, we started playing, and with, we weren't even a quarter way through the first movement, and I had a spring break on my G-sharp key. And so, you know, I had a moment, luckily, of lengthy rest while we were playing, so I was able to look and figure out what had happened, and sure enough, the spring had basically popped out of its hole. And so I basically ended up spending the rest of that movement not being able to play that note.
Oh, my God.
So I had to be very
careful,
creative on when I decided not to play the G sharps.
Right.
Yeah, but between movements, I was able to basically take a pencil and kind of shove it back up in the hole just long enough to hold for the rest of the performance. But it's you know, and of course that always happens, seems like, during a performance and not before or after or something when you can actually have the time to fix it. But
yeah, so it's happened to us all. I remember, and duct tape is your friend. So
that's,
you know,
that's
there's a lot of ways to get it done, and the show must go on. Musicians have a lot to deal with, you know, and giving them an insight into how their instrument works and what it does is very important. So we appreciate your giving them this opportunity, and thanks for coming in to chat about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the Producer's Vault, from the Student Recital Hour of Wednesday, February 13th, 2013, DePaul music major Andrew Bosomworth performs Joseph Pereira's In Other Words. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Anna Gadula, a student producer for Music for Life, and in this week's Student Corner, we're talking about the School of Music's preparations for our annual concerto competition, the winners of which will have the rare opportunity to perform with the University Orchestra at a concert later in the semester. I'm here with two of last year's winners, soprano Emily Barnash.
Hello.
And clarinetist Dan Hickey.
Hello.
So guys, what was your preparation like for concertos?
I had been working on my piece for about a year in advance. I did the Papers aria from the Console by Menotti. So yeah, it was like a year of preparation and all leading up to that one moment.
Wow. Scary. That's a long time.
I know.
Dan, how about you?
I did the first movement of the Mozart clarinet concerto. And when you play the clarinet, you don't not know about that piece by the time you're 12. So I actually had already played through it a little bit, but I didn't actually seriously work on it until about October of the semester before the competition.
So you guys did have a lot of preparation coming into the competition.
For sure.
Mm.
And what is the actual competition or audition process like?
So we have your first round, and it's just for the voice faculty, which is kind of nerve-wracking. Well, it depends, I guess, what grade you are, because we have juries, and it's basically the same thing as a jury. But I know for Dan and I, it was both our first time doing the concerto competition last year, so being the first time, it was really nerve-wracking.
Did you perform for the voice faculty, Dan?
Oh, sorry.
No, I was in front of some instrumental faculty. But yeah, it kind of felt pretty jury-like to me, and actually, I was more nervous for the first round than I was for the second round.
Really?
Which I thought was
What was
weird.
Different about the second round?
Well, the second round was in Kresge, and I had actually, on those lonely nights when you're practicing until 2 a.m., had gone up on there and played my concerto there. I kind of felt like it was more familiar to me, I guess. And plus, the judges were kind of scattered throughout the theater. You couldn't really see everyone, so it was kind of like you were just there alone.
The judges are outside judges for the second round, but do you guys know who they are?
I believe they come in from other music schools in the area, and I think just some professional musicians.
So during the audition process, did you guys have the mindset that this was a competition?
It was more of a performance than a competition. The first round feels like a jury, so you're kind of just up there doing your thing.
Mm-hmm. And the second round is different because it's I have to win.
Yeah, and there's people can sit in on the second round and watch. So it's kind of like a performance.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
That was a little nerve-wracking.
But then you have your own cheering section, and it's fun. People there to support you.
Did you guys have a lot of friends come during the second round of the audition?
I made a couple.
Just people that were already there.
So how did you guys feel when you heard you actually won the competition?
I cried a little bit when I called my mom. Well, since it was my first time doing it, I didn't know what to expect. So then when I went up to Professor Smith's door... Well, first, funny story. So we were all standing outside of his door, and he knew it. So he goes and puts the list up downstairs first. So he would, confused us. So that was already nerve-wracking. So then everyone was running around, and everyone was, crowded in front of the door. So I was, trying to wait patiently so they would... And it actually was a lot of people who didn't even compete, wanted to see. And so I saw it, and I screamed, and I scared everyone, and it was really awkward. And then I called my mom, and it was all exciting and stuff. So
Dan, how did you feel as a freshman winning the competition last year?
Well, actually, I wasn't in the building, so I didn't see the posted list. I waited for the email, and I wasn't even the first person to see it. Someone comes up to me, and they're like, Dan, congratulations. And at this point, I was just kind of over it. I was congratulations for what? I kind of forgot that I'd done it. He's the concerto competition. I was oh, wait, really?
Are you joking me?
I don't know if the freshman thing had anything to do with it, but I just wasn't expecting to win at all. So I was oh, well. Yeah.
What a pleasant surprise. Yeah. How did other people react when they found out you won?
Everyone was obviously really happy, but I had this one moment after the concert. It was the highlight of my year when Professor Valenzuela gave me my first hug ever from him. And it was a good moment. We really
bonded.
Yeah. It was really good.
And Dan, how about you?
I mean, I didn't get a Valenzuela hug.
I'm sorry.
Maybe this year you will.
I remember after the concert, I ran into Pam Coburn, and she saw what I was wearing, and she's like, you shouldn't wear a white undershirt under that. So that was cool. But
that's funny. How did you guys feel about the actual winner's concert?
For me, it was really fun having the chance to work with the orchestra.
Did you guys have a lot of rehearsals before the concert?
Just a couple. I was actually sick before the concert, so I missed one of my rehearsals. But then it was fine. But it was really nerve-wracking, and my piece was very emotional for me.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole experience was trying to get my emotions to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But with the orchestra, it was so much more than just with piano.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
Dan, how about you?
I remember I went right after you, actually, and she comes backstage and she has like tears on her face.
Oh, I was weeping. So I was weeping.
And I'm just standing there like, those are tears because it was a good job, right? Like, So I go on, and the piece I did had this big, like a really long orchestral introduction. And so I'm just kind of standing there waiting to start. And my family was in the audience. Mm-hmm. I like make eye contact with my little sister on accident. And she starts laughing at me. So then I start like kind of laughing on stage. And I was like, well, all right, this isn't as nerve-wracking as mm-hmm. I thought. Like, it's time to just have fun with it.
So are you guys competing again this year?
Yes.
Yep.
And how do you feel about this year's competition? Are you excited? Are you nervous?
I'm taking this one kind of more from a business standpoint. Like, last year was like the freshman, like, oh, I hope I win. This year's like, all right, I know what I need to do. Gotta get this done.
Yeah.
It's a little more intense, but less nerve-wracking.
Definitely less nerve-wracking.
Good. Well, best of luck to you guys. And
thanks.
Thank you.
We hope to see you again on stage.
From the producer's vault, DePauw music majors Dan Hickey, clarinet, Jenny Miller, violin, and Rachel Robin, piano, perform three movements from Igor Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale from the Student Recital Hour of Wednesday, February 13th, 2013. Thank you.
As we mentioned in the first segment with Matthew Valenzuela, we're thrilled that we have the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra coming to town this weekend, and we're especially thrilled that their guest artist is Thomas Hampson. And I believe I revealed last semester on the show that the way that we got Thomas Hampson was because of his connection to one of our alumni and faculty members, Pam Coburn, who's here to chat with me. Welcome back, Pam.
I'm glad to be welcome. Thank you.
Well, this is wonderful for us that you know Thomas Hampson well enough that I can drop names and use you to lure him here. You told us last time we chatted about this that you guys met in Europe, correct?
Correct. We met on the opera stage, actually. We did a production of The Marriage of Figaro together. Lots of Figaros.
You've been married many times.
Many times, and had the same trouble. Same man trouble.
History just repeats itself, doesn't it?
Yes.
The question that I'm hearing from all the folks is he as dashing and debonair as he seems?
Oh, yes.
He certainly draws a crowd.
I tell you, the charisma coming out of that guy is just incredible. There's just something about some people that have stage mm-hmm. presence that you're riveted. And it's not only because he's very handsome.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's like the trifecta here because he is very handsome, but he's an incredible voice. And he's also got this real charisma that is palpable.
Yeah. I don't think many people in the world have that. Mm-hmm. There are a few performers that just kind of command the stage, mm-hmm. and he definitely is up there with them all.
And it's interesting that your role here at DePauw now as faculty member is actually in the James B. Stewart faculty chair.
Yes.
And Thomas Hampson was the lead in Jim Stewart's opera.
I knew that. That's wonderful.
The founding of it, isn't
it? Yeah, kind of what goes around comes around.
Right, isn't that funny how that works? So last year, we did some scenes from Heart of a Soldier, which is a book by Jim Stewart about a person in the 9/11 tragedy. And last year, during our DePauw discourse with Yo-Yo Ma, we did some scenes from that opera that the San Francisco Opera had commissioned. And one of our own students played the role that Thomas Hampson actually did the world premiere of in San Francisco. So he's got some interesting DePauw connections, Thomas Hampson does.
Yeah, in kind of an indirect way.
Right.
And he's also from Indiana,
right,
Elkhart.
Which is really funny how all of those things kind of came together for the perfect thing. And we're thrilled that the Saturday evening performance of the Indianapolis Symphony is not in Indianapolis. It's here in Greencastle with Thomas Hampson. So have you guys kept in touch over the years?
We are on Facebook together.
And you guys sang together for quite some time. You kept running in the same circle.
About 10 years, off and on. So, You know, it's sort of like when you see someone after you haven't seen them in a while, if you know them well enough, it's like there's no time
gone
by.
Yeah, no time had passed in between.
So I'm looking forward to reconnecting with him.
So how did that work for you? You were contacted and said, we have Thomas singing in this production and we're thrilled to invite you to do it the same or to join in as well. Did you get, it's Thomas again? You know, was it kind of that feeling when you
Well,
came
the again? Opera was cast and I wanted to know the cast members, and Thomas and I were put together. Usually it's decided by the opera houses.
Right. So was it early in your career that the two began working together? Your careers, I should say?
I would say yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the first maybe 10 years, 15 years. So, mm-hmm. yes, and I've heard him many times in concerts and mm-hmm. on television.
Yes, right.
Yeah. So
he is quite the attraction. You know, he's everywhere. And we're fortunate that we have him doing a masterclass. Now, some of our listeners might not even know what that means. So what exactly does it mean that he's coming in to do a masterclass?
Well, since he's considered a master at his craft, usually students are chosen, or they, in this case, they auditioned in front of the voice faculty here at DePauw mm-hmm. to see who would be chosen. And four people is all the time that he has mm-hmm. for. So we listen to him and we pick the four, and then they sing that piece that they auditioned with. One of my students is singing a German piece, and of course that's his thing, mm-hmm. even though he is an American.
Right.
But he knows about Strauss and Mahler and so much. So he kind of gives his knowledge, and maybe in phrasing or interpretation. And I mean, I'm hoping that he's not going to find any technical problems the matter with my student.
So isn't this nerve-wracking? I mean, I can't imagine being an undergraduate and singing by myself for Thomas Hampson. It's got to be nerve-wracking.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I'm sure that's why they know their pieces. they could probably sing them backwards from the end to the front of the piece.
And I'll bet they're quaking a bit.
Yes.
So have you talked to them about having control of their nerves when they're standing on the stage alone with Thomas Amson?
Well, Emily Barnash is a pro. You know, she really is. She's had
she
so many performance opportunities here, and also Elisa Sunshine will be singing.
This is kind of an accolade in and of itself that you're chosen to perform in this masterclass.
Well, this is what's so wonderful about DePauw, and the fact that we have alumni and we have a fantastic fundraiser named Mark McCoy, who can get people like this here.
Yeah, we're thrilled. This has been terrific. And for our students, it would be a wonderful opportunity for our students just to simply sit and hear him sing with the ISO, but then to meet him and to work with him one-on-one, that's such a remarkable. And the other point is, this is not done by themselves. There's an audience, right?
Correct.
Our own students, the other students, all the rest of the students at DePauw can sit and watch you take a lesson publicly.
They will never forget this experience.
Right.
Never. And I think it will be a highlight in their lives.
And it's a way, you know, it's the way they that great artist pass it on. You know, your experience with Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, which was not a masterclass experience, you had that on a regular basis through lessons, is that correct?
It started out in a week-long masterclass. Yes.
And
then I went back to her periodically to kind of refresh.
Right. But the pressure was certainly on you in that situation, and now you find yourself in that situation where you're giving back to the next generation, but you do it much more kindly and gently, I do have to say. I know this about you.
Well, in all the student opinion forms, I've never gotten "she's mean and nasty."
You have high standards, but you're not mean and nasty to achieve those high standards.
Sometimes I'm tough on them.
Yeah, yeah. And you need to be.
Yeah, otherwise, you know, they kind of rest on their laurels.
Right, exactly. And you keep their feet to the fire. I know that about you. Well, this is just further evidence of the great things that go on at DePauw, because as I said in the earlier, I had absolutely no luck whatsoever making this happen until I could drop Pam Coburn's name, and now suddenly we can get Thomas Amson here. So thank you for making this happen, and we're looking forward to a great weekend.
Yeah, thank you.
From the Producer's Vault, this is a performance from the Student Recital Hour of Wednesday, October 31st, 2012. In which DePauw music major Erica Mattson, saxophone, and accompanist Katya Kramer-Lappin perform Pete Swert's piece, Kronos.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Music for Life. We love hearing from listeners. You can contact us by emailing musicforlife@depauw.edu. Our student producers are Adam Luman, Anna Gatdula, and Matthew Skiba. Our online editor is Veronica Pedrell, and our show is produced and recorded by Matthew Champagne in the Judson and Joyce Green Center for the Performing Arts at DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana. I'm Mark McCoy, Dean of the School of Music. Thanks for listening to our show. Keep music in your life, and have a great week.
It's Music for Life.